Hello and welcome to this podcast from Don't Forget the Bubbles. If you enjoy our podcasts, please tell your colleagues and subscribe on iTunes and Spotify. Enjoy! Hello and welcome to this podcast from Don't Forget the Bubbles. I'm your host today, Ian Lewins, one of the paediatric emergency medicine consultants in Derby. And I'm really, really pleased to be joined today by Dr. Shruk Messahel, who's, again, a paediatric emergency medicine consultant in the famous Alder Hey Hospital in Liverpool. Good morning, Shruk. How are you today?
Good morning. Yeah, we're good. Good up here. How are you?
Excellent. Yeah, very good. Thank you. So thank you so much for joining us. Shruk is one of the co-authors and one of the researchers behind the Eclipse study, which has just been published in this April's Lancet. So many congratulations on getting it published there.
Thank you. Thank you. It was good. It's good to see our hard work. I mean, this was Eclipse was about 7 years of work, which don't put off, you know, anyone who wants to think about doing research, but it's good to see it's finally published and people discussing it, and our results are being discussed, and you know, and there's a future for this, so that's good.
Excellent. So let's have a chat through then and the ideas behind Eclipse. So for those of you know, I'm sure everybody's aware that this was looking at alternative medicines for children who are in convulsive status. What was the sort of the thinking, but what was the background to it? Who sort of raised the question of this is something that we need to look at?
The giant of a man, Professor Richard Appleton, who's a professor of paediatric neurology at Alder Hey Children's Hospital, who is an epilepsy expert. And I think it was his idea to finally look at second line treatment. He'd looked at first-line treatment before in looking at use of midazolam versus other benzodiazepines in the paediatric emergency department to see if that could be introduced, and that was a successful trial. So he had already contributed to looking at parts of the APLS algorithm on status epilepticus, and there was this I think he had this nagging kind of question of, is phenytoin the right type of treatment? Is there anything else out there? And that very much coincided with what was actually happening on the ground, which was there was a shift in paediatric practice in children who were experiencing convulsive status epilepticus from phenytoin to levetiracetam. So they were using Keppra without very much in the way of hard evidence. It was anecdotal evidence that we're using. So, for example, in Alder Hey, the emergency department were using phenytoin. We were following the APLS algorithm. That's what it said. That's what we would do. Whereas the same child up on the ward, if they were having convulsive status epilepticus, they would get Keppra.
Oh, right. Okay.
So we had this, even within our own hospital, we had very different approaches to status epilepticus in children. And what we wanted to avoid was Keppra coming in without evidence.
Okay. Because it's really interesting that you guys, even in the same hospital, are doing different things.
Yeah. And I think that was reflected in other hospitals as well, when we spoke to people in the Peruki network, I think that was happening as well. But you know, it was very much first line treatment in PICU, for example, and that kind of crept down onto the wards. And you know, phenytoin was very much a reserve, I guess, on the wards and on PICU. But in ED, you know, we're algorithm based, and we were using phenytoin. And so it was a really interesting little environment that we had. But that question needed to be challenged, because what we could see happening was that it would eventually come in without actually any evidence, because everyone was saying, oh, it's much better. But really, was it better? we had to put that to the test.
Okay. And, you know, looking at the background and people saying, well, what, why do you need a second line? I mean, people are used to using benzodiazepines, whether it's in the community or in the ED as the first line, but it frequently doesn't work on its own, does it?
Yes, that's true. So our algorithm is, the APLS algorithm is time-based, and it's, 10-minute intervals. And the first lot of benzodiazepine uses after 5 minutes of convulsive status epilepticus, and then you have to wait 10 minutes and then give another dose, and you have to wait another 10 minutes. So, you know, by the time you get to second line treatment, if this child has had prompt treatment with benzodiazepines, you're looking at already kind of 25 minutes of seizures activity, which isn't good for anybody's brain. So it's really important to, if they get to that stage, to see if there's anything out there that can actually is actually better than phenytoin. I guess as well that this is the first proper robust trial looking at phenytoin as a second line agent. Phenytoin has been around for absolute ages, and there's been lots of anecdotal evidence or retrospective evidence or something like that, but phenytoin has never been put to the test like this, and particularly when you look at the evidence that concept trial has also given us. So, you know, there's these two studies now which are looking at phenytoin as well, to see if there is any evidence for phenytoin, which is good. It's a really good thing. It contributes to our knowledge of convulsive status epilepticus. Interestingly, what we found on work previous to this study was that there was such a varied use of benzodiazepines, despite all the good evidence for it and what the APLS algorithm has recommended, you know, two doses and then move on to something else. The information that we were getting was it wasn't consistent. The timings weren't consistent, and there was a bit more of if it's been used in the community, then you start from scratch in hospital. So some children were actually getting more doses of benzodiazepines than were recommended,
right.
And you know that leads to complications in respiratory drive and respiratory efforts. There's a lot of data here. I mean, we still have a lot of data from screening that we did with the Eclipse trial. We collected a lot of data on looking at first line treatment as well. So that still needs to be looked at as well. You're right. It doesn't always work, and there needs to be something which terminates the seizure in the emergency department. Because the next step is an RSI, and that's not without risk.
No, absolutely. And some people might say, well, hang on, why are you looking at heparin? What are the problems with phenytoin? From your experience, what are the difficulties with phenytoin?
So the difficulties in the ED with phenytoin are several. And now, remember that most of the EDs are very used to giving phenytoin. So in terms of drawing it up, knowing the dose, setting up the infusion, most of the EDs are really quite comfortable with that, and it's a cheap drug. So kind of everyone in the ED was relatively happy with using phenytoin because of those things. It was known. The problems with phenytoin come in twofold. So firstly, there were the described side effects or idiosyncratic reactions that you'd have. So the hypotension, the cardiac arrhythmias, the Stevens-Johnson syndrome, the purple glove syndrome, or purple glove syndrome, all those types of reactions that were well described with phenytoin. And the second point is that phenytoin is an unforgiving drug. If you make a mistake with phenytoin, then there's likely to be some serious harm. And you don't really want to add that to a critically unwell child in a time-critical situation where, maybe access is a little bit difficult and you're trying to think of other things and you're trying to resuscitate this child and you're trying to deal with the parents. And, you know, in that environment in recess, you don't really want to add in an extra, oh, my goodness, if I make a mistake with phenytoin, it could be a disaster. The Royal College of Emergency Medicine had actually put out some safety alerts regarding phenytoin. Because mistakes have been made with phenytoin. Yeah. Giving it as a bolus, for example, instead of as a 20-minute infusion, or giving it as a continuous infusion and forgetting to turn it off. So unfortunately, those children actually died from consequences of that. So it's not without risk. And,
no.
And taking as much risk out of the emergency department, I think, is something worthwhile looking at and certainly doing.
Absolutely. And of course, the other issue with phenytoin is that you have to give it over 20 minutes as well.
Yeah. Yeah. So when we were looking at levetiracetam and trying to decide how we would give it in the trial, the evidence that was available was suggesting that we could give it over 5 minutes, which seemed a really good thing to do, which seemed to, because again, you know, if you're getting to 25 minutes after your benzodiazepines, if you're stuck to time, and then you're adding another 20 minutes of phenytoin and watching this child seize, you know, that's 45 minutes of seizing. Whereas the concept was, 25 minutes and then only 5 minutes of levetiracetam infusion, then you've shortened that down already. But the results didn't quite show that, did they? But
yeah. Well, let's move on then to sort of think about the design of the study. Was the idea to sort of demonstrate that Keppra was as good as phenytoin or was better than phenytoin? Because this is quite an important point, isn't it?
It is. I think from what we had read before going into the trial, we read that levetiracetam was better than phenytoin. It was a better drug. And it was better at in terms of its side effect profile, but also in terms of its seizure cessation rates, and that it would stop children from fitting really quite quickly. That's what we read. So we designed the study to be a superiority trial.
Okay, and that's important as opposed to a sort of a non-inferiority trial. Yeah. So it was set up as a superiority trial. And just very, very briefly, what was your age group of the people that you were going to recruit to this, and how did you go about sort of getting other emergency departments involved?
So we included patients from the age of 6 months to 18 years. And the reason why we chose that was because seizures in children, in babies under the age of 6 months, are very different in nature and require a different approach. And we extended it to 18 years because of the mixed departments. There are some departments who see children, the pediatric side see children up to the age of 18. And so we didn't want to restrict it to just the standalone children's hospitals, which would traditionally only see children up to the age of 16.
Okay.
So it was important to enable the district general hospitals to recruit in a pragmatic way as possible. So the 17-year-olds, 16 and 17-year-olds, would come to the paediatric side. You didn't want them to kind of say, oh, no, aren't we? And in that situation, you know, where it is an emergency, trying to make it as pragmatic as possible was the way forward.
Okay. And my understanding is you managed to sort of recruit patients from about 30 emergency departments in about 3 years. Is that right?
Yes, we did. So this was one of the first multi-center studies. And it was one of the first on several fronts. So it was one of the first Peruki multi-centre studies, but it was also one of the first Peruki research without prior consent studies.
Yeah.
And on a large scale like this, in emergency departments, in resources all over the country, it proved that not only did the Peruki network work, but also research can be done in resource departments across the country on children in an emergency. So it was really good on that front.
Yeah, I mean, and that's incredibly important, isn't it, from a UK perspective as well as globally, really, isn't it?
Absolutely, because I think in terms of paediatric emergency medicine research, I think we're quite new to this compared to globally, compared to the setup of Australia, New Zealand, and North America. I think it's about time, you know, that we got something like this going. There's no reason why we couldn't have done this as a country, as a nation, and I think there was appetite for it as well. You know, when I was in training many years ago with you,
not that many.
You know, there was no such thing as paediatric emergency medicine, was there? You know, in a specialty in its own right. So the fact that we've come on so much, and now that we are doing our own research into our patients, is really, really quite important. And it does set the stage. It does open the doors for other research to happen in our emergency departments.
Absolutely. So you briefly touched there on this idea of sort of deferred consent or entering trials without immediate consent, and that's really important. What for those who've not come across that, what does that mean?
Okay, so I think deferred consent is more commonly known as isn't quite what describes actually what happens.
Okay.
And so research without prior consent is probably a better descriptive term. There is going to be the results of this is a sub-study within ECLIPSE that's going to come out looking specifically at that aspect of this trial. So on the ground, what it meant was that the clinicians who were recruiting patients to this study, because it was an emergency and because it was time critical, we had ethical approval to be able to enter children into this trial without needing to approach the parents or the caregivers for consent. We did need to approach them within 24 hours.
Yeah.
Explain the study and then ask if we could use the collected data in the trial. So they kind of couldn't do anything about the fact that the child was in the trial, but yeah, they could do something about whether or not they could include their child's data. So it really isn't it's research without prior consent. That's the best descriptive term of it. What we found, which was really quite interesting, because I was one of the clinicians who would approach parents afterwards, and parents were really quite interested, and they were engaged. And they wanted to participate into a future evidence base. They wanted to be able to contribute to this. They wanted to use that experience that their child had and that they had to turn it into something positive. And what we found was that there were very few parents who actually dropped out of this trial.
Okay. Well, that's really interesting, isn't it? Because you might think... And I think maybe a concern was people would turn around and go, why have you entered my child into a trial without my knowledge or without my consent?
How we went about explaining to people that that this is how the trial was going to work, because in a lot of centres this was going to be the first, not only the first paediatric emergency trial, but also the first paediatric emergency trial without taking consent beforehand, and yeah, clinicians were very worried about how that was going to play to the parents, and was there going to be backlash, and what we were able to say to them was that the parents in previous studies were okay with this, and it was mainly the clinicians who were a little bit reserved in actually approaching parents, because we didn't quite know what to say. We'd never had those conversations before.
Yeah.
And having a framework maybe for how to approach a conversation, and certainly sharing tips during the trial with other centres of saying, you know, this is how I approach this parent, or this is what we did for this one, and sharing that knowledge of how to approach parents in a research study was very valuable. What I found personally was saying to them, it was an emergency. You know, we were trying to stop your child from seizing. You could see that we were doing, and they were like, yeah, we could see that, because they were often in the room. It really helped that levetiracetam and phenytoin were both used in that situation. So it wasn't like this was a completely de novo drug and we didn't quite know what it was, what the effects would be. They were both, yeah. So that type of thing certainly helped ease them into trying to understand that we had a valid question. It was ethically approved. And we really wanted to find out what the best drug was for future children. And they were completely on board with that.
Okay. That's great to hear. So let's move on then to sort of practically how people went about it. So you've got your child, you've pre-alerted that they're in status. And you normally get a bit of a handover from the crew or pre-alert from the crew to say that they've had this benzodiazepine, they've had that benzodiazepine. What happened next then?
So there needs to be a screening process for the child. So the screening process was about making sure that the child was eligible for the study and also getting some information about what the child had already had and if there was a personalised rescue care plan. The screening questions included, the things like, if they were suitable in terms of their age, if they had any allergies, if they had stuck to either the APLS algorithm to start off with or their own personalised rescue care plan, if they were known to have to be part of ECLIPSE before, or if they were known to be pregnant, or things like that. And those were two important points because it was a deferred a research without prior consent trial. You couldn't kind of go up to the parents and say, "Oh, have you been part of ECLIPSE before?" So only if they were known to be part of ECLIPSE was that an exclusion criteria. We didn't want clinicians to be then distracted by a conversation with the parents about a research study when actually their focus of attention should be on the clinical situation at hand. If the child was eligible, so tick boxes eligible, then were they eligible for randomization? And if they're eligible for randomization, then you needed to, because there were two points then of starting the study, one at the point of randomization and then the second at the point of actually starting the trial medication. The randomization was done with envelopes. We try to think of the most simple way of doing this in the middle of the night in the emergency department, and it just seems paper and an envelope was the most pragmatic way of doing it. And now in the envelope was a research form which had highlighted areas in yellow or orange to say that this is the information that is crucial, otherwise we will miss the primary endpoints. The rest of the information that we can collect at another time, but if you can collect it at that time, then that's great. But it was mainly times. So what time did you randomize? What time did you start the medication? Was the medication complete? What time did it finish? And what time did the seizure stop? So these were all really important questions. You couldn't get the primary endpoint without them. The other information that was collected at the time were things like, was this their first bit? Where did you put the cannula? I'm trying to think of the CRF now.
How many times is it?
Things like that. The other thing that we had in with that was almost an idiot's guide of how to make up phenytoin and how to make up Keppra. And I think that was really useful for nursing staff because
absolutely,
didn't need to try and find how to give it or things like that. And the information was to hand. And we made sure that individual departments made sure that information was acceptable from their pharmacies and from their trust perspective, and in majority of cases it was. So that kind of information readily available to hand with very minimum information to be collected in order to get a primary end care point was how we try to design this trial to be as pragmatic as possible. You know, worst case scenario in the middle of the night.
Yeah,
resources are. It's really interesting because I'm working on another study at the moment called the FOR study, which is an orthopaedic.
Oh, yes, we're involved in
You're
that.
You're involved in that, good, well done. And that's completely electronic. And so the randomization is electronic and the consent is electronic. And I think that is also a really good way forward in using technology in research to assist us in the emergency department, because we need something that's quick and that we can consent to and randomize really quickly. I think the only issue with that is Wi-Fi is a bit patchy in some places, but that seems to be a good way forward as well.
Okay. So I've got the numbers in front of me. So over the period, there were 1,432 patients assessed as eligible, 404 randomly allocated to treatment. So 192 to phenytoin, 212 to Keppra on an intention to treat basis, 134 got phenytoin, 152 got Keppra. Does that seem about right to you?
Yeah.
Good. And thinking then, so that's your group. Thinking about then about the intervention, very straightforward. You either got phenytoin at 20 mg a kilo over 20 minutes, or you got Keppra at 40 mg a kilo over 5 minutes.
Yeah, that was pretty much it. It was as straightforward as possible. It was as pragmatic as possible, and it was just comparing one drug against the other. As soon as those infusions finished, it was very much up to the clinician how they were going to continue to treat this child. So at that point, they exited the clinical pathway of the trial. And, you know, if the child was still seizing, it was up to their clinical discretion to do whatever they felt was necessary. If the child wasn't, then again, up to their clinical discretion as to do what was necessary for that child. So so we tried to hone it down to just one specific point. And I think that contributed to the success of the trial. I remember the conversations that we had when we were designing this, and you know, we were really trying to strip it down to its bare essentials, because there's so much information that we could collect, you know, so much information that we would want to collect, you know, it's interesting. But in order for it to work in the emergency department in this way, we had to make sure that it was completely doable in the pediatric emergency department. What we also made sure of was that the GCP wasn't an issue. In a lot of studies, the treating clinician were needed to have their GCP valid.
Yeah.
What we ended up being able to say is that if the principal investigator has got their GCP and the person who is approaching consent has their GCP and completing all the forms has their GCP, then the clinicians on the ground do not need their GCP.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting point, isn't it? Because, you know, often that can be a stumbling block to recruiting people for trials, that because it's all well and good if your principal investigator's there, but you know, a lot of the time they're not. A lot of the time, if it's the night, it may be a registrar that's seeing the child, and maybe they don't have GCP. Yeah. So that's a really good point.
Yeah. And in an ideal situation, we'd all have our GCP. You know, it's a good introduction into research, and I think it's something that that we should all have. But practically, it's something that quite a few people don't have. And I think research in paediatric emergency medicine is, again, I think it's something that's coming up. So people don't know that they need to have it. Research isn't on their agenda when they come to the paediatric emergency department. So I think that culture is slightly changing. But there's certain ways that we can ensure that a trial is deliverable. And one way is saying, okay, if there is patchy GCP, then we'll take responsibility for it. Because in this type of clinical question, the patients won't come in 9 to 5. They won't come in Monday to Friday. These kids will come in any time, and it's completely unpredictable. You can't predict, oh, it's a Friday night, we're going to get three at least. You know, you can't predict.
Yeah.
You can kind of predict with trauma, perhaps, or maybe with respiratory conditions. But with status epilepticus, I don't think you can predict when a child is going to come in status. So it was really important to be able to ensure that recruitment of the patient that does come in is it can be done with the clinicians there at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. So then we've done our bit. We've screened the person. They've been randomised to one arm or the other. Really important point now then was, what was your primary outcome for the study?
So the primary outcome was, when did this child stop seizing? And we left that to clinicians' discretion. There was some guidance that we gave. We went to all of the emergency departments that were open, and we provided some training. And one of the training points was, you know, when does a seizure end?
Yeah.
And trying to kind of describe, you know, that what constitutes ongoing seizure and what doesn't is a little bit tricky, but we did provide some guidance, and we left it to clinicians' discretion at the end. There's always, I think, going to be a little bit of issue with that. You know, when did the seizure truly finish?
Yeah.
Again, just going to back as pragmatic as possible. If the clinician thinks that they've seized and they're not going to give any other medication for it or any other treatment for it, then that's what we were going to go with. That's what would happen in real life. That's, you know, so that's what should happen in a trial.
Yeah. And, you know, as you say, it can be difficult in practice to determine exactly when a seizure stopped, which might introduce some bias into this. But actually, the other side of it is it kind of reflects what we do every day, really, doesn't it?
Yeah. So I know that in the concept study, they videoed, and they tried to independently say when a seizure had finished, but not entirely sure, again, if that was the most robust way of doing it. I don't think there is a robust way of doing it. I don't think either way is 100% perfect, but I think it's what we do every day, and so we left it up to the clinician's discretion.
And, of course, I guess if you're being videoed, whether that influences your decision making might come into question, mightn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's your primary endpoint. You know, how long does it take you to stop? So what did your results show?
That there was no difference between phenytoin and levetiracetam, which is fine. They both had a seizure. Hold on. I think my editor just get out. Hold on. Where is it? Sorry.
I've got it as 60% in phenytoin, 75% in Keppra.
Sorry, you're gonna have to probably say that question again.
No, that's fine. So I'll just clock the time on that. 33. So moving on then, what did your results show? What did you find?
So that there was no statistical difference in this way of looking at it between seizure cessation rates of phenytoin or Keppra. And they both had a similar amount of time to seizure cessation, and they both failed at seizure cessation at a similar percentage. So not much difference really with the way that this trial has been designed.
Okay. And my understanding is that Concept found sort of fairly similar results, really. No difference between the two groups.
Yeah, which was really interesting, because the information that we had prior going into this study was that the results from phenytoin were much, much worse. So we had information to suggest that phenytoin's rates were about 50%. And so we were thinking that it would be around that ballpark figure, but this was higher than we thought.
Okay. And then looking at the numbers I've got, so saying that the median time to seizure cessation was about 45 minutes in the phenytoin group, 35 minutes in the Keppra group. Still a long time, isn't it?
It is, which is disappointing for both drugs, really. Not what the data on levetiracetam before we went into the study had shown. This was the first robust data that anyone's ever had on phenytoin. So it was really interesting to see that not only were they both similar, but they both took a long amount of time. Not entirely sure why. Maybe it reflects the ongoing process that it is now difficult to stop the seizure, because we know that, you know, once you get into status epilepticus, it's really difficult to break that cycle.
Yeah. And again, looking at those people who had additional anticonvulsants, that they were similar for both groups, is my understanding, about roughly a third of all those patients.
Yeah, as well. So, that was the up to the clinician's discretion. So if they needed to have another anticonvulsant after the study medication, then that was up to them. So that was data that we were collecting. We weren't recommending one over the other after. So that was interesting that they felt the need to give, that they needed to give more after both drugs. It's not as clear cut one way or the other. And I think that's surprising. I think that's also surprising that the concept studies have found the same. But that's good evidence base to then work forward.
Yes. And I mean, I guess it potentially brings into question actually both of these drugs for sort of second line treatment, doesn't it, if it's such a long time?
Yeah, it does. But it's what we were doing. And we now have the data to show what we're doing.
Yeah. So the conclusion really is there's no significant difference between phenytoin and Keppra in the second line treatment of pediatric convulsive status.
Yeah. I think the other side to it was, were the side effects any different? The side effects going into this, we thought that phenytoin would have the worst side effects, particularly the cardiovascular instability and all the stuff that we talked about before about, you know, it's more unforgiving. We didn't see that in phenytoin. We saw an episode of hypotension, which was related to phenytoin. But we didn't really see the other cardiovascular side effects that we thought we were going to see. Or that have previously been reported. Now, whether this is because this is a trial and the kids are monitored more closely and the information is gathered in a different way, maybe that's why. Or it could just be that actually what was reported previously was higher than actually anticipated. But I think the potential is there for phenytoin to cause problems in the pediatric ED, and maybe just on that issue alone, I think that's certainly what the ALSG will now need to reflect on and see whether the APLS guidelines need updating with this new evidence.
Okay. So these both the concept and the eclipse were published, and, you know, as we say, demonstrated no difference really between the two groups. And from my perspective, looking on social media, Twitter in particular, it seemed to be jumped on that we should now all use Keppra. Should we be changing practice, do you think?
That's really interesting. I followed it on Twitter as well, and it was really interesting how I think people were hoping that levetiracetam would be better. And when it wasn't demonstrated statistically to be better, it was that was still taken as enough. You know, if they're both the same, I'm using Keppra. You know, type of situation. It is easier to give. There's less monitoring that you need, and again, this this concept of if you make a mistake with it, then it's more forgiving. And it is used as a ongoing oral maintenance anticonvulsant therapy. There are very, very few kids now who are on oral Keppra as their long-term maintenance anticonvulsant therapy. So that kind of concept of, well, great, there's no difference, so I'm using Keppra. It was really interesting to see that that was some people's take on it. Mm. I think with the publication of both these studies, it was very exciting, and exciting on numerous levels, not only because of what the results showed, but also because of the concept of doing a study like this in the paediatric emergency department. And it was anticipated. And I think that was just kind of excitement, really. I think what should happen now is a consensus approach.
Yes.
So I think what's more potentially damaging to children is individual clinician discretion and treatment. I think that's potentially more damaging than a a formal consensus approach, reviewing all the evidence, getting people's opinions, and then formulating a way to go forward.
Absolutely. So having published this, what's kind of next? What's next for the data that you've got? What can we expect to see coming from this group?
I think two things are in the pipeline. So firstly, the information on the you're going to have to edit this out as well. I lost my words. God, what's it called? My God, what's it called? Seriously, consent study. It's actually called the consent study. Looks like, okay, all right. Go on, ask that question again.
So having sort of finished this initial bit of the study and got it published, what's next for the group? What's next for the data that you've got so far?
So I think two things are going to be in the pipelines. So two things to look out for. First is the research without prior consent study that's going to come out. Kerry Warfel and her team have been fantastic in embedding a nested study within this, the consent study, and that's going to come out, and that's going to look at qualitative aspects of research without prior consent in the parents and clinicians who have participated in this study.
Yeah.
The next part is actually looking at all the screening data. There's a lot of screening data that we have, looking at what actually happens to these children before they receive the second line treatment, which was what this study was interested in. But there's a lot of data there on what benzodiazepine and where they received it and at what dose and the time intervals. So that's hopefully going to be looked at as well.
Fantastic. Well, we should look forward to that with great anticipation. And I guess it just remains for me to say, Shruk, thank you so much for joining us today. And thank you for you and your group for putting this really important study, which demonstrates that, as you say, Peruki as a group works. And I think, that's the most important part of this study.
Yeah, I do. I think that this study shows that you can do research in the paediatric emergency department. I'm not an academic. I started this as a trainee and have really appreciated the value of that and quality that research brings into the emergency departments. And I would highly recommend our trainees and our clinicians who have never really thought of participating in research to actually get involved. It's a whole new world, and it really makes you question the things that you do and actually want to improve them. And if you really do want to improve treatments for children, then this is the way to do it. This is the way to go forward. I think more than anything, this study shows that you can do research and you can do it well in a paediatric emergency medicine, in recess, in the middle of the night. There are ways to do this. and this trial has shown that. So onwards.
Absolutely. Shuk, thank you so much for joining us today. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to this podcast from Don't Forget the Bubbles. Remember, you can subscribe to our feed on iTunes and Spotify. Thank you for listening.